Hello, Coffee House Shops listeners. My name is Freddie Gray, and I edit The Spectator's US edition. I know you're all huge Westminster enthusiasts, but Brexit is over, and the big story of 2020 is going to be the American election. So I would like to urge you all to listen to my Americano podcast, where we discuss everything that's going on in Trump world and Democrat world. If you go to spectator.co.uk/Americano, you can listen to it all.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm John Connolly and I'm joined today by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. There are now 19 confirmed cases of coronavirus in the United Kingdom, including the first case in Wales this morning. This morning, the former Health Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, went on the radio and said there could be up to 100,000 people's lives at stake. He also said we need to start talking about the social and economic trade-offs we need to be prepared to make to keep the virus count low. James, what kind of steps do you think the government should be taking at this stage?
So I think your introduction highlights the kind of paradox of the coronavirus. We've got 19 cases in the UK. No one in this country has died from it yet. Yet, this is already beginning to have profound economic consequences. You look at what's happening to the stock market, the supply chains disruption, because the kind of workshop of the world, China is operating at kind of half capacity at best at the moment. And so I think this is... But then the question becomes this, right? Which is, to what extent do you take preemptive measures to try and stop the spread of the virus that will have economic consequences? So to take a small but telling example, the Irish Rugby Football Union are saying that they're going to cancel their Six Nations game against Italy to try and prevent the spread of the virus, because international sporting events hit two of the criteria for things that spread the virus, because they basically bring large amounts of people together in one place,
yep.
And they've also travelled from lots of different places to get there. And so that has a big impact. But obviously, when you start doing this, there begin to be, you know, consequences, economic and social. You see Japan, they are now shutting all the schools. They're shutting all the schools because they wish to try and get the virus under control so that they can say, well, let's go ahead with the Tokyo Olympics. But obviously, if you shut schools, says concerned parent, that has profound economic consequences, because that basically means that parents end up not being able to work, and on we go. So I think this is and you see China has struggled with this question, which is, how do you balance out the desire to prevent the infection from spreading with the economic hit and the social hit you take from stopping these activities?
Katie, I mean, there's been some rumblings of discontent already, I think, from those who've been infected with the virus or believe they've been infected with the virus about this sort of the guidance they're receiving from the government. Do you think there's a sense that the government are handling this well so far?
I think what you have to bear in mind is I've never really heard, when it comes to something that could be disastrous for the country, someone saying the government really handled this outbreak of a virus spectacularly. So it's hard to get too much of a gauge on this. I think it's fair to say that Matt Hancock, the health secretary, has been accused of having some confusion in his direction. And I think he has changed some of the things he said, or at least clarified, might be how the Department of Health would put it, comments as the week has gone on. But I do think with something like the coronavirus, the information changes every day because you're trying to get to grips with a changing fluid situation. So at the moment when the government is talking about self-isolation, it could be that coronavirus gets to such a point of concern by the weekend that the guidance starts to change and it becomes a different tone coming from the government. One of the things, I think it was a week or two ago, was they changed some of the guidance, but that was partly because they wanted to make sure that people who they thought might have coronavirus and were in isolation couldn't leave the units they were in. So I think you have to bear in mind that sometimes when things look as though they are a PR change, where it's like, oh, well, you said this yesterday and you said that today, that is trying to adjust to what you have to do to protect people in the country. I think it is going to get more challenging because clearly the fact that this hasn't been contained in China, the fact that there are now multiple cases in Italy and the first case in Northern Ireland, more in the UK, reports of what might be happening in Dulwich, it's going to escalate. And even if it doesn't go into a full-blown pandemic, it's going to get much harder for the government to, I think, probably keep the public calm while also stopping the spread.
There is also, the view is that as the virus spreads, it becomes less deadly. because viruses basically have a kind of evolutionary, we really are testing my scientific knowledge here, right? So, but people cleverer than me tell me that, and people who know more about science than me tell me that basically viruses wish to be in as many places as they can possibly be. So basically, to survive, a virus spreads out and it becomes less deadly. So there then becomes a question, which is, you know, the perceived death rate for coronavirus is meant to be about 2%, right? If it gets to the kind of pandemic stages where a huge tranche of the population is getting it, that fatality rate will probably drop from 2%. Now, it is worth noting here that even 1.5% or 1% of a large number is a large number, right? You know, so I'm not saying that, but I think that is a kind of interesting question about what you do in terms of how you handle this from a public health point of view. And you know, is it really possible to kind of lock the country down? You know, I think there is a paradox here, which is the other day in Canary Wharf, various firms sent its staff home because they were about coronavirus. They all went and got on the tube to go home. So, you know, which I mean, is that real? I mean,
but then also good luck getting an Uber.
No, but I mean, this is the point, right? Which is, how do you balance all this out? I think is difficult. But I think one of the things, you know, not to sound Joe Moorish, but one of the things that this is going to have big impacts on is the government's, you know, is economic growth, and that therefore then starts to have a big impact on what the government does in terms of the economy, in terms of the fiscal rules that Sajid Javid was talking about in his resignation statement. So all of this is now looking more likely than not that coronavirus gets to a stage where it begins to have significant public policy implications on these kind of big economic questions.
And in other news, Boris Johnson has continued to come under criticism for his lacklustre approach to the floods, which are damaging large parts of the Midlands, North and South. Katie, you've written about it in your Guardian column today.
Yes, so you had Jeremy Corbyn this week going on the offensive when it came to suggesting that Boris Johnson is a part-time prime minister. And to do this, what the Labour leader said was, you haven't visited any flood victims, you haven't been seen in public for 12 days prior to PMQs, yet you somehow managed to make it to the Tory black and white annual fundraising ball. And I think it also fits into your pattern, whereas you've often heard over the past couple of weeks the words, where's Boris? When you had the Iranian general assassinated, Boris Johnson stayed in his Caribbean holiday. He sent the foreign secretary out to front that response. Lots of people are saying, you know, this is a lazy prime minister, he's not doing anything. I think that it comes down to a bit more than that, in the sense that this isn't cock-up, it is actually strategy. Mm. You might not like the strategy, but ultimately a decision has been made that a lot of the things which are expected of a prime minister, so getting out there, you know, photo ops, not really for the good of the general public or the of interest to most members of the public. Instead, they're there to entertain journalists, also you can have a Twitter storm when the Prime Minister is then, you know, most likely heckled. And I think that what this number 10 are trying to do is change the pace of political coverage to a degree, and also what's expected of a Prime Minister. So go back to before even Tony Blair. I think since then there's a sense it's got very PR-y. People expect you to do these things all the time. So it fits into that, this idea that he's not going to go out just because the media is saying, where are you? Are all Tory MPs on board with the strategy? I would say not every single one. I think Tory MPs who represent constituencies affected by the flooding do feel like it would have been a good thing to have the Prime Minister out there. But they also think it would be good to have a quicker response in terms of the packages being offered to those affected. So I think, had the other one worked, they might not care so much if the Prime Minister was there. And I also think the new intake are all a little bit surprised, because you have these Red Wall 2019 MPs who got very used to Boris Johnson going to their patches, you know, banging the drum, talking about how important it was to have the Tory presence here. And they haven't really they thought that would continue to a degree. But I think the reason you're not going to see too much of Boris Johnson in that way is ultimately the sense that they just don't think the public care that much if they see him or not.
I think Katie's column is the best explanation of Downing Street strategy, but I mean, there is a problem with it. They need to find another way of showing that you care. The Downing Street strategy reminds me slightly of someone saying, I'm not going to get my mother flowers on Mother's Day because I am grateful to her for being a mother 365 days of the year. So why should I pick this one day on which to bring her a present or breakfast in bed? The problem is, it is a way of showing that you care. And Boris Johnson's problem is that turning up at these events and meeting the rescue workers, you know, helping with a few sandbags. You know, yes, the prime ministerial effort does not make a material difference to the quality of a sandbagging, but it is the accepted way in our news culture. And I understand Katie's point is that they want to try and change the news culture, but it is the accepted way that you show that you care. And it also, I think, the other argument for it is it does send a signal into the bureaucracy about how seriously this is being taken by the top. So although I think Katie's column has a very good explanation of the thinking behind it, I mean, they still haven't got over this problem. And at the moment, I still think they risk being like the kid who says, well, I haven't got you a Mother's Day present because I, you know, every day I value you as a mother.
Yeah, I think all the stuff comes from your political strength. So at the moment, Boris Johnson is high on political capital. He's still in his honeymoon period. If he chooses not to do something, I think that you can read it as it's their decision not to do it. Mm. But if things start to get more difficult, you know, a couple of years on, and as we saw with Theresa May, it got to the point where, because she looked like such a weak leader, if you told me, well, actually, she's not doing this because she just thinks that it's, no one actually cares whether she does this or not. So are you having one? She's terrified of the public reaction that she's going to get because she's so unpopular in the country. So I think these things, you have to respond to things as you find them. I also think it's a flexible approach in the sense, if I or James wrote a column saying, this is awful, they need to get out there, I don't think it would have, as influential as clearly James is, I don't think it would have that higher level of impact because they just think that the commentators and the commentariat is slightly irrelevant to this. And similarly, if there's a Twitter storm saying, where's Boris, and that's trending, I think that's less of an issue. But if you start to see in the polls a general backlash amongst the public and what they see as their demographic, then I think it would give them pause for thought and he would be out there more.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening. And if you ever needed a reminder to go and buy flowers for your mother, I think that was it.